Well, it's almost 21 to 7 here on Classic 102.7. Time to peer underneath the cover of ever-expanding umbrella funds. Now, we know umbrella funds are being driven by the FSCA and Treasury to a degree to cover more retirement savers under the promise of economies of scale and increased member investment choice. And we do see this ever-increasing burden of regulatory compliance. It means that the operational costs of funds become disproportionate. And additionally, the productivity costs of having both employer-appointed and member-elected trustees engaged in the affairs of the funds means that the prospect of the umbrella actually becomes quite attractive. Now, to look at the umbrella fund and what the practical and regulatory challenges inherent in this are, it's a great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Mort, the founder of Jonathan Mort Inc. He's one of the country's foremost pension attorneys. Jonathan, it's been a while. Hope you're keeping well.
I am, thanks. Good to be with you again.
And also on the line, I've got Mike Stowe, who's the CEO of Hold Consulting. I think his line has just gone dead. We've parked it. So I'll welcome Deirdre Phillips of Bowman's. Deirdre, great to chat again.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing exceptionally well, thanks, as we try and get Mike on the line there. Jonathan, kick us off. When we look at this drive towards umbrella funds, for listeners out there, just contextualize why the industry is heading in this direction.
Well, there's an ever-increasing compliance and regulatory burden being put onto standalone occupational funds. And especially for the smaller funds, it certainly seems to make sense for them to migrate into bigger umbrella funds where they do have economies of scale. Apart from that, it also frees up employers from having their employees and executives involved in the management of the fund. And there's usually some big sponsor and some brand behind an umbrella fund, which tends to give some form of security to many of these employers who may be wanting to do that.
Now, Deirdre, when we look at some of the issues here, I think one of the standout issues is the inherent conflict of interest that could creep into the umbrella fund structure. Just take me through some of those conflicts.
So the one that is talked about most in the umbrella fund environment is probably in relation to trustees. So typically, as Jonathan had mentioned, it's sponsor driven. So, for example, the administrator would put the umbrella fund together, and typically the trustees that are appointed as the directing mind and will of the fund would be trustees elected by the sponsors. So some of the conflicts arise in relation to the independence of those trustees and whether or not they will be following an agenda of an administrator, for example, or some type of other agenda. So where you have in your typical standalone environment, you have a lot of say, or the employer has a lot of input and the members may have a lot of input, that is actually detached in an umbrella fund environment, because the fund is so big and consists of various thousands of members.
And Jonathan, when we look at this, I guess the clear objective isn't altruistic here, but to enable the sponsor to profit from it. There's nothing inherently wrong with the profit imperative, but it does raise some concerns, obviously.
Yes, I mean, the problem is the sponsor sets us up on the basis that it will provide services or products to the fund, and that's not the basis on which an employer would set up an occupational standalone fund. So an occupational standalone fund would normally have complete freedom to go and choose its own service providers, invest wherever it wants, and that is not usually the case, by and large, with umbrella funds. So there is quite a sort of captive environment in relation to the service providers and the products which the sponsor usually provides, and it's in that way that the sponsor makes money out of it. And
so,
and,
what happens to investment choice? What happens to investment choice then? I mean, if these are being driven by the regulators to provide greater investment choice, what you just described is actually narrowing investment choice.
Well, I'm not sure that the regulator is that keen on investment choice. we've seen with the latest default regulations coming out that the regulator is more concerned about having proper defaults, because the reality is that most members do not want member investment choice. And there is a view that says that the only reason that member investment choice exists is so that the investments can be on a platform and the sponsor can make money out of the existence of a platform. So, I don't think there's a problem with a sponsor's product being on that kind of platform, but I think it shouldn't be the only product available. Mm.
It's just in my experience, and maybe I can bring Mike Stowe in because we've got him back on the line. Mike Stowe, CEO of Hull Consulting. Evening, Mike. My experience has been that when one has a bit more choice and can shop around, one can generally get a better deal.
I think that can be the case, although the point that Jonathan makes about the costs of LISPs and of hidden administration is a reality in umbrella funds and most platforms in South Africa. My concern, Jonathan, perhaps with the defaults, is that it entrenches really the sponsor's admission or automatic right to invest the money, because I could not see, for example, that Sanlam as an umbrella administrator would not have their own funds as their default, or the same way with Alexander Forbes and Investment Solutions or any of the other administrators. So although defaults sound like a wonderful idea, and I do think that the intention is very well merited, I think the implication of it can actually be counterproductive and have the effect that members can be locked into high-expense investment strategies without knowing any better that there are alternatives. So while I agree with Jonathan that internationally it does show that people tend to make unwise choices when it comes to exercising investment choice, that is not necessarily the case. And I am wary of defaults, which may make the sponsor, effectively by law, a regulatory default for that fund.
It does narrow the competitive space a little bit. And Jonathan, just in response to what Mike was saying there, surely this must be one of the concerns being grappled with at the moment in light of the default.
Well, the default regulations do say that the fees and charges in respect of the default investment must be reasonable and competitive, taking account of the size, asset allocation, and other characteristics of the fund. So, look, I fully accept that this could simply be a mechanism for the sponsor to want to have its own product as the default, but then it must be very careful about justifying it, and especially as against those criteria that I've just mentioned. And there could be a basis for a member holding the trustees responsible for constructing a default which it's simply out of the sponsor's products, which are at a higher cost or are proven not to have performed as well as a competitor's products. So I think these umbrella funds will need to be very, very careful about the construct of their umbrella their default investment arrangements.
And I mean that would make sense, Deirdre, to bring you in that trustees here have a fiduciary duty to you, the retirement fund member. That doesn't change in an umbrella, surely. So if the trustee is in an arrangement that seems to benefit the sponsor over the trust, over the member, the member has full rights here.
Absolutely. One thing I maybe just want to bring in, especially which is unique to umbrella funds, is where there is member investment choice for the fund. Usually that is that function, and when we talk about trustees, that's delegated by the trustees to what umbrella funds usually call MANCO. So that's the management committee of the employer. So typically in an umbrella fund environment, which I've seen, the fund would say employer or MANCO, there's about five portfolios, investment portfolios out there. You pick some of them which you think matches what your member's investment appetite would be. But then again, a member may, if they want to opt out, they can choose some type of different investment portfolio if they want to. But at the end of the day, that delegation of the investment portfolio options to Manco doesn't necessarily mean that the trustees can abdicate their responsibilities. The buck stops with them at the end of the day.
And Mike, this has the effects of the board of the fund delegating its functions. However, it cannot abrogate them. What oversight role is put in place to retain ultimate accountability here?
Well, I think there's a lot of potential for fiduciary conflict that remains in place, and I think it's questionable, no matter how good the intentions of these regulations are, whether there's really enough being done to prevent there from being conflict of interest. In most of these umbrella funds, the sponsor is also the asset manager, is also a consultant, is also an administrator, the actuary, the evaluator, everyone is connected as part of that. And the question of the employer taking responsibility and having a fiduciary duty, I think, is real, and it's something that perhaps Jonathan could perhaps elaborate on more than I as a legal point. But in my experience, employers are not well positioned, certainly not medium and smaller size employers, to make decisions about investment choices or costs. And in fact, they are generally led by the nose, so to speak, by the particular financial advisor, often tied to an insurance company or the sponsor, as to what is reasonable. So I find very little comfort, actually, in the regulation in that. As I say, I have read it carefully, and I do find the intentions all good, and I'm certainly going to help. But in terms of how does one address the shortcomings, I'm not so certain that these will necessarily resolve many of the inherent fiduciary conflicts, which could have been challenged in any case, but had not been for decades within these umbrella funds.
Yeah, because the stories are rife of what some might deem relatively minor issues. A trustee accepting a bottle of whiskey from a company that provides a service to your retirement fund, or when a trustee owns a stake in a company that provides a service to the fund. All of those things have been going on for a long time. Jonathan, from the legal perspective, what oversight role is put in place to retain ultimate accountability here in this Manco environment?
Well, there are two models of Mancos out there in the market. The one allows for there to be independent service providers to that Manco, and that's often where there's a very wide range of investment choice made available to the employer outside of the sponsor's product. And then the other model is where the Manco cannot have its own independent service providers and must simply be follow what the benefit consultant, who's usually in the employment of the sponsor, not must follow, but they are usually guided by that benefit consultant. So the problem with these Mancos is there's an asymmetry of skill, expertise, and knowledge, because the benefit consultants usually have far more, and as Mike was just saying now, many of these people involved, it's not their core function, they don't have training, the financial services environment is very technical, and it scares a lot of people, so they would inevitably defer to the people they see as experts. And those people mostly, unless one has the model of the Manco model of having an independent service providers, which are usually only for the very, very big employers, usually they would just follow what the benefit consultants and the employment of the sponsor say. So the problem is of true independence, and ultimately, the real problem is making sure that the trustees are properly independent, not so much the Mancos, but the trustees in this sort of environment shouldn't really contain people in the employment of the sponsor.
Yeah.
And they should actually be properly independent and not constrained by the sponsor.
But is it not true that we see a lot of the boards of trustees of umbrella funds are dominated by the senior employees of the financial services company that sponsors the fund? And therefore, as senior employees, they're also likely to have some kind of share option based on the profits made by the sponsoring company. So there's an inherent conflict here.
Well, it's hard to disagree with that. I mean, even if they don't have share options or something, they have a fiduciary duty to their employer to see that their employer's commercial proposition around the umbrella fund succeeds. And, you know, it's what their day job is. It's very difficult to change hats when you move from one room to another.
Training, so training here for me then is critical, isn't it? And Deirdre, to bring you in here, training of trustees, and if functions such as choosing an investment strategy and assisting with death benefits and all of those things, shouldn't Manco members also not be adequately trained?
Absolutely. I mean, we see that in a normal instance where the Board of Trustees, some of them battle with training themselves. And we know in 2013 amendments were put in place in the PFA, the Pension Funds Act, to suggest some type of training or qualifications, and nothing further has happened in that regard. So where you have Manco, who does not owe a fiduciary duty per se, and they make important decisions, i.e. Investments, they absolutely need to have training. And I think that needs to be regulated, or at least put in the rules, and where the board delegates those investment functions to Manco, I would like to see, you know, what systems and procedures are put in place to ensure that those people making the decisions are, you know, equipped to do so.
Mike, back to you. One trustee of an umbrella fund told me recently that there isn't really a conflict of interest because the trustees follow the rules of the fund. The question is, who drew up the rules of the fund in the first place? Because most often it's the sponsoring company's employees, is it not?
Well, indeed, that is the case. And for me, I'm a cynic, I'm afraid, after a few decades in this industry. And I follow the money. And I think it's more than coincidental that the money in asset management is what drives really the interest in sponsoring umbrella funds. It's certainly not done from altruism. And we'd be naive to think that asset managers and insurers are doing this for any reason other than to profit. Having said that, for me, one of the positive signs perhaps of regulations going forward is not so much Manco's, because I have the real confidence in their ability and expertise, but more in the retirement benefits counseling and the possibility of independent advice. I think if there are any parties that are perhaps able to hold sponsors accountable, that would need to be an employer rather than a Manco. Mm. And I think that in terms of members, I think education of members as to the costs and benefits of the investment choices would be far more valuable to me as a consultant, certainly, and I think right. The members themselves.
Well, that's the exciting thing about the role of the benefits counsellor is they have the knowledge to hold the feet to the fire of those individuals who need to be held accountable, and they start balancing out that asymmetry of power. Jonathan, I certainly would not want to be in the position where I, as a trustee, as an employee, have to weigh the profits of the company and the size of my paycheck against the interests of the members of the fund. That are also in my fiduciary ambit. But I want to end off on an issue around insurance, because we are running out of time. Just quickly, members of Manco's aren't officers of the fund, as far as I understand. So are they covered by the fund's insurance policy? Must the fund cover the Manco members? What happens here?
Well, my understanding is typically they are not covered by the fund's public indemnity cover. It depends on how the if responsibility is actually delegated to the Manco, and some Mancos are not constructed on that basis, but if there is responsibility delegated on that basis, then they should definitely take out PI cover, and that PI cover should be a cost to the fund, because it's fund business for which they need to be covered. Otherwise, it's not fair to expect them to carry that responsibility.
Just as a parting shot, I mean, we've just managed in a very short space of time to put our fingers on quite a few issues with umbrella funds. Is it are these conversations that you're having currently with the former FSB, the now FSCA and Treasury, and how open are they to look at these in ways in which we can tighten up the system?
My understanding is the FSCA is very definitely aware of these issues, and we've seen aspects of it released or covered in the FSCA's draft guidance notice around Section 7B applications, and that's where you apply to be exempt from having member-elected trustees. It's the provision that typically applies to umbrella funds where you just have an independent trustee. So the FSCA is aware of the need to tighten up and improve the governance around umbrella funds. And in that particular draft guidance note, there is, for example, a requirement around at least 50% of the trustees must be independent, and there are quite strict rules around independence and responsibility and so on, which is encouraging. So I think there's definitely movement in the right way.
Well, Jonathan, unfortunately, we have to end it there. We've run out of time. That was Jonathan Mort, founder of Jonathan Mort Inc., who was joined by Deirdre Phillips of Bowmans and Mike Stowe, actuary and CEO of Hull Consulting, talking about some of the unique set of legal and compliance issues that umbrella funds create.